For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and on today's show, we'll be chatting to historian and author Maggie Craig about her Glasgow and Clyde Banks series. We'll also have a look for some new books in the RNIB Talking Books Library. All that and more on today's Read On. Maggie Craig is the author of historical non-fiction, such as When the Clyde Ran Red, a social history of Red Clydeside, and a history of both the men and the women of the 45, some of the lesser known Jacobites. She's also putting together a small YouTube video about Hugh Mercer, who was a Jacobite doctor and a general in the American Revolutionary War, more of which later on. She's also an author of fiction. Her Glasgow and Clyde Banks sagas are a love letter to the people and places she grew up with. There are six books in the series, all narrated by Leslie Mackey. Book one is The River Flows On.
Michael had turned to look at Kate. Young as he was, he seemed always to be interested in his great-grandmother's stories. "What was the launch like, Grandma?" "Oh, it was grand, real exciting. When she hit the water, she caused this huge wave." Kate lifted a hand to illustrate the size of it, and everyone standing on the other bank of the river to watch the launch got soaked. Michael laughed in delight. Kate laughed with him, remembering another occasion. She would tell him that story later.
That's Leslie Mackey reading from the first Glasgow and Clyde Banks saga, The River Flows On. And author Maggie Craig joins me now. Now, Maggie, give us an overview of the whole six-book series. What are the Glasgow and Clyde Banks sagas about?
Well, I think of them as a debt of honour I owe to my forebears. I was lucky enough to have a lot of really good aunts and uncles who told me all sorts of stories, and none of them were very well off. A few of them grew up in quite a lot of poverty. But they always had lots of things to do and lots of things to talk about. So it's not about them. It's not taken from them. But it takes its inspiration from them. But although one thing I'm always trying to emphasise to people is that people might be poor, but that didn't stop them wanting to do things and to know things. And even though they maybe didn't stay very long at school, they had a lot of them had such a thirst for self-education. So it's about that, and it's about my love of my hometown, Glasgow, and history as well, but weaving it all in to make a good story.
And before the first Queen Elizabeth, there was the Queen Mary, and she was the finest ship of all, the pride of the Clyde. Her ship, she thought, the Queen Mary would always be her ship, hers and Robbie's. She smiled down into the child's upturned face. His lips pursed in concentration. He was nodding in agreement with her. "I know," he said. "My dad told me all about her. She's in California now, and one day we're going to go and visit her. He says that my great-grandpa helped build her."
Now, first off, The River Flows On takes place against the background of the building of the Queen Mary and Clyde Bank.
Yes, I grew up right on the border between Clyde Bank and Glasgow, and people always spoke about the Queen Mary. And I remember someone in his garden had sort of topiary, of which was of the Queen Mary. And it was such a big thing. It had been such a big thing. And it was such an emotional thing. And it was also, you know, as people used to say, when real men did real work. So I think there was quite a nostalgia for that.
Kate smiled, both at the North American twang in that grandpa and the note of pride she heard in the young voice. "Your great-grandpa and your two great-great-grandpas and your Uncle Davy all helped build ships on the Clyde. Now, isn't that something? Gee!" He exhaled a long breath. it lifted the lock of fair hair which had fallen forward onto his forehead. "Say, Grandma, maybe I could build ships when I grow up." Kate smiled sadly. "No, Michael, I don't think so. There's hardly a shipyard left on the river now. When I was wee, the age I am now..." "The age you are now," Kate agreed. "When I was wee, the river was lined with shipyards." She turned, lifting her arm to indicate the Erskine Bridge behind them. "From right up in Glasgow, way upriver from the bridge there, down through Govan and Yoker and Clydebank and Dalmuir, along to Dumbarton, over there on the other bank." He was following her pointing arm. "Where that big rock is?" "Yes, where that big rock is."
Another clip from The River Flows On. Now, these books, they're all standalone. You can read them in any order.
Yes, there's a bit of overlap of characters between the station master's daughter and The Bird Flies High. It doesn't matter what order you read them in.
Now, in book two is When the Lights Come On Again, and the backdrop of this one is World War II and nursing.
Yes, because also if you grow up in Clydebank, you know, of my vintage, you always hear the older people talking about the Blitz. And when you're a sort of careless teenager in the late 1960s, you think, oh, they're talking about the Blitz again. And it's only later that you realise what a big deal it was and what a momentous thing it was. I was lucky enough to be able to catch a friend of the family who had lived through the Blitz, Maisie, and she told me lots of lovely stories, so that really fed into all of that. Nursing, because I've never wanted to be a nurse, actually, strangely enough, but my heroine wants to be a nurse, and her father's very strict, and he thought nurses were no better than they should be, as some people did. So that's her struggle in the book, to prove herself to her father, really.
Yes, because we usually associate the Blitz with London, but it did happen, albeit to a lesser extent, in Glasgow and Clydebank and other places in Scotland.
It did, and there was a couple of nights of the Blitz in Clydebank in March 41. There was a Blitz in Aberdeen, there was a Blitz in Greenock, there was a Blitz in Edinburgh. London had it on a much more prolonged basis, which I think is why you hear so much about London. But there's a figure that in Clydebank, only it's either 7 or 8 houses were left undamaged by the Blitz. It devastated the place, flattened the place. A lot of people had to move and find relatives who would take them in further away from Clydebank until there was some rebuilding done.
"Where do you think you're going, young lady?"
"Up the road to my grandfather's," Liz flung back. "I suppose that's allowed."
She had never openly defied him before, but the depth of her disappointment was giving her a courage she hadn't known she possessed, even if it was making her heart beat faster and the blood pound in her ears. Was there a medical term for that? If William Macmillan had his way, Liz was never going to find out. She took a step away from the table. Her mother, who had been hovering nervously behind her, moved away to stand by her own chair, miserably aware of the distress this confrontation was causing her. Liz knew, nevertheless, that right now she had to get out of the house before she said something she would really regret. "I'm going up to Radnor Street," she said, consciously lowering her voice. She'd not get anywhere by shouting and stamping her feet. Not that tantrums of that sort had ever been tolerated in the Macmillans' household anyway. Taking a deep breath, she forced herself to calm down. She was 18 years old now, a young lady. She should act like one.
Now we're moving on to the station master's daughter. I lived across the road from where this one's set in Partick Station.
Well, I actually moved the station because I'm a station master's daughter and I grew up at Westerton, which is a couple of stops up the line. And I thought, but it would be more interesting to set it in Partick because you could have the girl in the station master's cottage who's quite protected. And then outside we've got Partick, which is working class area, as you know. So there was more things to be sparking off. And I've got a big thing about railways. One of my uncles was on the railways as well as a signalman, and then working in ticket offices, topical topic. So the railways mean a great deal to me.
And it seems to be in the books that the main character is a female, and there always seems to be a male involved as well. Is there love in the air in all these books?
Oh yes, well, I'm a romantic as well. So not all sagas are romantic, but I always like to be a love story in there. I don't know, but some people split hairs and speak about love story and romances. I don't mind the word romantic, but there's always that happening. But the other thing is that both he and she have their own battles to fight, and there's their own demons to contend with. So when they do finally get together, I think it's more satisfying.
The Piwe men had a tough job, out in the open all day and subject to the vagaries of the climate. In the case of the west of Scotland, those were considerable. Freezing fog, ice, slush and snow, scorching heat and torrential downpours. The fine misty rain, which could go on for weeks, penetrating coats and jackets and shoes. Sometimes, as the old joke went, you got them all at the same time, although that wasn't really a joke at all. Everyone had experienced days when Mother Nature flung all four seasons at you at once. "No thanks, lassie," said one of the men. "But it's kind of you, all the same." He tipped his bunnet politely and headed off down the platform. Three of the other men followed his lead, leaving only their foreman standing by the fence, and Ewan Livingston. She darted another glance at him. Was she imagining that faint look of reproach on his pale face? Sharkey surveyed them both thoughtfully. "I'll be getting on too, Miss Burgess. But you in here'll take a glass of your lemonade, won't you, son?" They stood for a minute or two gazing after the ganger, watching as he caught up with the rest of the squad. Heavy-footed in their working boots, the men clattered over the bridge to the other platform, and then were swallowed up by the cavernous exit at the end of it. It framed a steep flight of stairs, which led down into the hustle and bustle of Partick.
Now we're moving on to The Bird Flies High, and there's a battle in the background of this one in the form of the general strike.
I was brought up in a very political household, and I've also written a book about Red Clyde's side, when the Clyde ran red, so a non-fiction book. And I wrote that, I took certain things out of that and decided to put them into fiction. The two complement each other. So my dad was Old Guard Labour, so he brought me up on all these stories of the Red Clyde Siders and the general strike. So that's why that became such an important struggle in that book.
And also in the background, we've got the Hungry 30s.
Well, it was really tough. People, I think history repeats itself. People literally couldn't afford food. My dad lived in Coatbridge, and he spoke about there was a farmer nearby, and he spoke about them sometimes going in over the wall and stealing a couple of turnips and taking them home to his mother, and the farmer turned a blind eye because they're just the money wasn't enough money to go around, and a lot of people were unemployed, a lot of people were thrown out of work, so people had a tough time.
The overcrowded houses, poor living conditions and dead-end jobs created a potent situation in which slights and resentments, real or imagined, often festered and exploded into violence. Long before closing time, men would spill out onto the streets looking for trouble. All too often, they found it. Huddled together in the box bed, the furthest they could get away from the window, Dorothy Collins sat with one arm around a trembling Charlie, her other hand resting on Rachel's hair, legs drawn up. The girl lay with her head in her mother's lap, eyes squeezed tightly shut. It was impossible to shut out the noises.
Leslie Mackey, who narrates all of the Glasgow and Clydebank sagas, reading from The Bird Flies High. The books are standalone, but we're going through them in the order they were written and released. And next up is A Star to Steer By.
All of these books have got a strong sense of place, and they're all about a place that matters to me. And I grew up in Westerton, and then my father died and my mother moved to Annie's Land, and my husband and I bought the station house at Westerton. And it's, I love Westerton. It was a really nice place to grow up. And we used to quite often walk along the banks of the Forth and Clyde Canal, which is just there at Westerton, and also Annie's Land, but all mixed up in it. So it was that sort of idea to be somewhere in Glasgow that I hadn't dealt with before. And then the thing that came on board there were the puffers. Again, you know, writers can move things, not quite mountains, but there were puffers built at Kirkintilloch, and I moved the puffers to Temple, Annie's Land, and there's a struggle. Again, there's a lot of class struggle in these books. There's the boy from the big house, and there's my girl who's from the tenements in Annie's Land. And obviously it's more interesting if you can get people like that together, because they'll strike sparks off each other, and hopefully it'll make for a more exciting book.
Also in this one, we meet the razor gangs in Glasgow.
Oh, aye, yeah. Sort of, it was funny when I was writing this book, something wasn't clicking. And I was just driving, actually, and I was going through the scene in my head, and Ellie had got caught in a fight. And then somebody said to her, "What the hell are you doing here, Ellie?" And I actually said out loud, "And who the hell are you?" And that turned out to be Frank Rafferty, who was one of the I think he's a great character, a really interesting character. So he runs with the gangs and he gets slashed and he regrets it. It was a strange time in Glasgow, I suppose. The poverty and those sort of things and people doing without led people to go in different directions. And one of them was the gangs, which were huge at that period.
"What the hell are you doing here, Ellie? Come through this way. There's none of them in here yet." His father might still retain the Irish brogue to which he'd been born, but Frank Rafferty Jr. was as much a Glaswegian as Ellie herself. As he dragged her into an unoccupied back court, her fear-filled eyes drifted to the lane. The man who'd been slashed was struggling to his feet. He got a boot in the face and went down again. "Ellie, get a move on!" Frank half-pulled and half-pushed her through a close and out into the street beyond. It was empty, all of the action taking place on the other side of the building. "Away home now, hen," he said, giving her a shove in the right direction. "I wouldn't like to see you hurt." "Well, you know, come wi' me, Frank." Poised to dive back through the passageway, he flashed her a roguish grin. "And miss all the fun? No bloody likely." "Oh, Frank, I thought you were never going to get involved in all of this. You used to say it was a mug's game." "No so easy when you're a Rafferty, Ellie. Certain things are expected of you." "Oh, Frank," she said again, "come away with me now, before you get hurt." He shook his shaggy head. He was a redhead like Ellie, with thick, wavy hair the same shade as boiling toffee. She had always thought it gave them a kind of bond. "Can I do it, hen?" The regret sounded completely genuine. Then he vanished, swallowed up by the close, consumed by the erupting violence.
A clip of A Star to Steer by Leslie Mackay. All of these books in the Glasgow and Clydebank sagas are available commercially. A Star to Steer by is available in the RNIB Talking Books Library in Braille. Now, the final book in the series is got a cheerier background. It's called Dancing Days, and you say the whole city was dancing.
You know the old one about, are you dancing? Are you asking? I'm asking, well, I'm dancing, that sort of thing. I came in at the tail end of that. We used to go to the Students' Union in Strathclyde Uni because that was mainly a university with a lot of men in it, boys. You could just say you were a nurse and they would let you in, even if you weren't a nurse, which my friends and I used to do. So it was to get that whole thing about the dancing and how keen people were to dance and how smart they were in their smart threads. So that was the sort of germ from where that book came. You say it's cheery, but the dancers were what was called in America, the taxi dancers. people could buy a ticket and could dance with the dancers, but it was also a cover for some less salubrious activities than dancing. So that's what happened in that book.
Could this be what it felt like to drink champagne? Favoured, if the newsreels were to be believed, by bright young things and dashing royal princes alike, that exotic and expensive drink had never passed Jean Dunlop's lips. Bubbles of excitement were coursing through her veins all the same, plunging from the top of her head to the soles of her feet, before shooting all the way back up again. She was here at last, at a real live dance in a real live dance hall. She was so excited she could hardly breathe. That tonight was Christmas Eve made it all the more special. Most of the people milling around waiting for the dance to begin would be off work tomorrow, only because of the happy accident of Christmas Day falling on a Sunday this year. The big Scottish festival was next weekend, Hogmanay. But Jean's mother had always liked to keep Christmas too. Fighting the urge to glance just one more time across what seemed like the miles of gleaming wooden floorboards that separated the two genders, instinct told Jean to at least stop fidgeting. She settled for standing with her arms by her sides, her nervous fingers concealed by the generously cut folds of her frock. She became aware that she was under scrutiny from her own side of the Great Divide. The peroxide blonde, in the low-necked and sleeveless glittery silver dress and matching evening shoes, was giving her the top-to-toe treatment. The young woman's eyes lingered first on Jean's long fall of fair hair before passing down over her dress to her shoes. She murmured something to her friends, standing next to her on the edge of the dance floor. One by one, with that surreptitious glance that inevitably follows the instruction, "Don't look now, but there's a girl over there," each of them did exactly what she had done. None of them tried too hard to conceal their amusement at what they saw. Once they'd had their fun, they resumed their unabashed scrutiny of what talent there might be among the young men shuffling their feet on the opposite side of the hall. Jean knew fine well what they'd been laughing at. She wasn't exactly dressed for dancing. Her sensible black leather lace-ups were much too sturdy. She wore no makeup. Her hair was unfashionably long, and her dress was an unmitigated disaster.
Now, the research for these books, judging by your answers, it was sort of organic. You grew up and you knew people like your characters in the book.
Yes, although my second home is the Mitchell Library in Glasgow, where I found a lot of stuff. I spent a lot of time in the Mitchell finding out what was going on at certain times, and I found out about an account, for example, of when the Queen Mary was launched, and somebody writing quite a satirical, comical article about it, about how proud people were of this happening, and all sorts of other things. And during the time of the suffragettes and the general strike, what was going on. So a lot of it's from newspaper reports.
And I'll precursor this by saying that the following books we're going to talk about aren't available in audio just now, but I recently watched a talk you gave about Hugh Mercer, and you've written quite definitive histories of Jacobite females and Jacobite males as well.
Yes.
So your research goes back further than the 1930s at least.
Yes, I'm actually compiling a wee YouTube on that, so hopefully I can, once I can master the technology of YouTube, I'll hopefully put that up. We were on holiday in America in April, and we went to Savannah in Georgia. And there's a lovely 19th century, there's several 19th century houses, and one of them's called the Mercer Williams House. And it was notorious because it was the house that featured in Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, which is about somebody shooting somebody else. But I heard that Mercer, and I thought, I think I know where that Mercer fits in. So that sort of set me off on a journey. So I went looking for Mercer. He was a student at Aberdeen University. He graduated at 18, which people quite often did in those days. They went to university early, and he was a doctor. He was a surgeon at Culloden, and he escaped from Culloden and eventually escaped to America. So I thought it'd be interesting to follow him. And he's often described as a forgotten hero. He's known in the places in America where he fell in the Battle of Princeton. Otherwise, he's sort of got forgotten about, and he was certainly forgotten about in Scotland. So I'm now on a mission to make sure he's not forgotten about.
It seems like if he hadn't died of his wounds, he would be maybe not as famous, but up there with George Washington.
I think he would be, because someone wrote a book saying second to no man but the Commander-in-Chief, which is what somebody said about him. And I think Scotland, sometimes we're quite bad with our heroes. We remember some of them and not others. Aberdeen University has a plaque in just saying a student of this college. But a member of the public suggested that this was done comparatively recently, and they didn't know about him. So it seems a pity that this great American hero has been forgotten about in his home country.
You need to write the book.
It might be just a wee book, so we'll see. I think I've got certain periods of history that I like. I'm no good with the Middle Ages. I don't like the Middle Ages. So certainly the Jacobites and the 19th century, I find the early 19th century, I find interesting, and the Red Clyde Siders and so on. Yeah.
Tell us about your book about the Jacobite females.
I did have a problem with a well-known Scottish newspaper who decided it was too shocking. And I thought, really? Considering what you hear in the street every day. So it's Damn Rebel Bitches, the Women of the 45. And that was because that was how someone else, not the Duke of Cumberland, that was how they were described as that. I got a wee bit fed up with, you only ever hear about Flora MacDonald. So that was certainly research done the old-fashioned way, going to the Public Record Office in Kew in London, where they have a lot of records, including one referencing Flora MacDonald, which says she'd been arrested for carrying off the pretender's son dressed in women's apparel. And I think, oh, that's the Betty Burke story. That was confirmation of when Charlie was disguised as a female to get him off Skye. Also, again, in the Mitchell, in Edinburgh, in Aberdeen. Aberdeen's got great records when it comes to the Jacobites. And then after I'd done that, my son said to me, what about the men? You know, for gender balance, you're going to have to write a book about the men. So that's when I did Bare Arse Banditti, which again were what their enemies called them. And I do have a chapter about Bonnie Prince Charlie in there. I've changed my opinion on him. I feel sorry for him. I think his life was laid out for him and he didn't have much choice as to what he did. But I wanted to look at so-called ordinary men and find out what they had done.
As I said, those history books are only available in print and as ebooks, but all six of the Glasgow and Clydebank sagas by Maggie Craig are available in audio commercially. And Maggie, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been lovely talking about these books.
If you have a question about living with sight loss, no matter how big or small, the RNIB helpline is here to offer support, whether it's connecting to your Wi-Fi or connecting to your community. From remote banking to TV remotes. Call us on 0303 123 9999 or say, Alexa, call RNIB helpline for more information. RNIB, see differently.
RNIB Library has all the latest reading titles in a format that suits your needs. You choose the books, you choose the format, we deliver to your door. Follow us on Twitter at RNIB Library or find us on Facebook.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. Now let's have a look in the RNIB Talking Books Library for some brand new titles.
The publisher W&N from the Hachette Group has recently given us King's Counsellor, Abdication and War, The Diaries of Sir Alan Lascelles, by Sir Alan Lascelles.
On the 13th of November 1935, the King's private secretary, Lord Wigram, sent Tommy a telegram from Buckingham Palace. Thanks for your letter. The King and Queen are delighted and you will receive a warm welcome. On the same day, he wrote, My dear Tommy, thank you so much for your letter of the 11th instant, which I was so glad to receive last night on return from some day's shooting. I at once telephoned the good news to Sandringham, and I need hardly say how pleased the King and Queen are that you can join the household staff. You will come in as Assistant Private Secretary to the King, and I understand that your consolidated pay will be £1,500 a year. If we can get a house for you, so much the better, but I cannot commit myself about this at present. With all good wishes, and I'm much looking forward to having you as a colleague. Yours ever, Wigram. On the 14th of November, Alexander Harding, Assistant Private Secretary to the King, wrote from Sandringham. My dear Tommy, just a line to say how very delighted I am that you will shortly become a colleague. I hope that the life will suit you, and I feel confident that it can be so arranged that you will have plenty of liberty, by which you, like me, set great store. The King and Queen were extremely pleased when I went and told them, and I can assure you that everyone is delighted at the prospect of your coming. Yours ever, Alec Harding.
As Assistant Private Secretary to four monarchs, Tommy Lascelles had a ringside seat from which to observe the workings of the royal household and Downing Street during the first half of the 20th century. These fascinating diaries begin with Edward VIII's abdication and end with George VI's death and his daughter Elizabeth's coronation. In between we see George VI at work in play, a portrait more intimate than any other previously published. This compelling account also includes Princess Margaret's relationship with Peter Townsend and throws an intriguing new light on the way in which King George VI and Winston Churchill worked together during the Second World War.
I think the fog began on Thursday. It came down like a blanket, as thick as I've ever seen, and for 3 days we sat motionless on the Atlantic, which was luckily placid as a pond, seeing nothing except for a brief half-hour after tea on Friday when the curtain rolled back as if by magic and revealed a handful of really formidable icebergs all round us. Then down it came again, but the glimpse was quite enough to prove to those who do not know the North Atlantic that our captain's extreme caution was amply justified. There'd been brief intervals by day and night when, very gingerly, the ship could nose her way forward at the pace of a rowing boat with her siren and those of the two escorting cruisers roaring in a head-splitting symphony every 2 minutes. But they were negligible intervals, and during those 3 days I don't think we got more than 40 miles nearer Quebec. Meanwhile, with the time of our final arrival slipping more and more into the middle of next week, I was sending long code telegrams to Ottawa suggesting successive reconstructions of our mangled programme as one alternative position after another had to be abandoned. At last the sea began to move a little and the wind to stir a little, and by lunchtime we could see again after 3 days of practical blindness. And when we did see, it was a remarkable sight. A wall of ice, looking like a continent, stretched across the horizon on both sides of us. There was a channel to the southwest, and down it we fled, followed by the two cruisers. The sun was out by now, and it was a lovely afternoon. After steaming hard for a few hours, we successfully rounded the southern promontory of what must have been a vast ice field. Our 3 fog-marooned days were really very curious. Michael Adeen said he got the feeling that we had all been dead quite a long time. It was rather like that, a strange sensation of being suspended somewhere right outside the world with no dimensions. Space was limited to the grey wall outside, and time was non-existent. We might have been there 3 days or 3 months. The only experience that I have ever had at all like it was when at Whitsun, 1914, I was snowed up in the Andes and spent 2 or 3 days in a derelict hotel with a trainload of total strangers. But that was a gloomy episode, and here we were, all from their Majesties downwards, in hilarious spirits, at any rate till the last half day, when we all, I think, were beginning to get a little apprehensive about ever seeing Canada at all.
King's Counsellor, Abdication and War, The Diaries of Sir Alan Lascelles, is read by Pip Torrens and runs for 14 hours 22 minutes.
We were recently given this true crime book by Stephen Dials in the Hachette Group. Inside Parkhurst was written by David Berridge.
Here I was, just 3 weeks short of my 32nd birthday, in prison. I'd left a perfectly good job to be here. Been on the slow, steady path to promotion. My previous employer had even put me through college. But I didn't want to work in an office, and the prison service looked interesting, challenging, and rewarding. So much more than just a job. Now, as the huge wooden gate slammed shut and I stood nervously waiting. I was beginning to wonder if I'd done the right thing.
During his 28 years working as a prison officer, David Berridge has had to deal with it all. Serial killers and gangsters, terrorists and sex offenders, psychopaths and addicts. Inside Parkhurst is his raw, uncompromising look at what really goes on behind the massive walls and menacing gates. Thrown in at the deep end, David quickly had to work out how to deal with the most cunning and volatile of prisoners and to learn how to avoid their many scams. He's been assaulted and abused. He's tackled cell fires and attempted suicides, riots and dirty protests. He's helped to foil escape plans, talked inmates down from rooftop protests, witnessed prisoners setting fire to themselves, and prevented prisoners from attempting to murder other prisoners. And now he takes us inside this secret world for the first time.
I thought about the opening scene of the television sitcom Porridge, in which the voiceover passes judgment on Norman Stanley Fletcher, played by Ronnie Barker, as a habitual criminal, and imposes a sentence of 5 years before the gates of the fictional HMP Slade similarly slam shut. Shrewsbury Prison was old, and it showed. A large, imposing Georgian prison, first built in the late 1700s. It was affectionately known to the locals as the Dana, owing to it having been built near the site of an even older prison, the medieval Dana Jail. All sorts of thoughts were racing through my mind in this strange environment. So alien, so oppressive, and so frightening. It was like entering the underworld, a place of misery, evil, hate, and condemnation. It was, for some, quite literally the end of the road. My senses were working overtime. The smell, the noise of the gates clanging shut and reverberating. I felt like a prisoner in my desperate thoughts. But thankfully, I wasn't alone. There were five others in the same position as me, all as different as could be, a range of ages and sizes. None of them necessarily looked like I'd imagined a prison officer to look. But then I was pretty sure I didn't look like a prison officer either.
Inside Parkhurst by David Berridge is narrated by David John, and runs for 10 hours and 28 minutes.
For those fans of Clive Cussler's Oregon Files adventure series, they're now being continued by other writers. The latest is Firestrike by Mike Madden, which was kindly donated to us by Penguin Random House.
The vintage Soviet-era snowcat crested the final rise on the steep climb. Its big diesel engine belched a plume of oily smoke as it roared with the effort. It had taken 3 hours clanking through a narrow pass high in the towering Pamir Mountains through the swirling snow to reach the ancient Tibetan fortress. It loomed above the forested valley floor, perched on the edge of an insurmountable cliff. Its sturdy walls could resist the siege weapons of its day, but the fort's remoteness and sheer inaccessibility had always been its primary defense. All but the most determined visitors were deterred from even venturing here. How the mighty stone edifice had ever been built by ancient hands in this location several hundred years ago remained a mystery. The snowcat finally ground to a halt just opposite the short drawbridge crossing the abyssal chasm. The cab door opened and a sturdy Chechen in a sheepskin coat and boots leaped out, then opened the rear doors for the seven esteemed guests. The passengers, 6 men and 1 woman, stretched out knotted muscles and aching backs from the long, monotonous ride. They had sat in silence for the entire trip, sizing each other up with sidelong glances in the snowcat's spacious but utilitarian cabin. Outside in the frigid air, their breaths jetted out of their mouths, but the vapors were quickly swept away by the biting wind.
When Juan Gabrilo, captain of the Oregon, is hired to extract an undercover operative in Kenya, he finds himself on the trail of a deadly international plot. A Saudi prince seeks to unleash a deadly assault on US forces, sparking a new war in the Middle East and ultimately destroying Israel. In their quest to stop him, Cabrillo's crew are about to meet their most fearsome enemies yet, a force of biohacked soldiers endowed with extreme strength and stamina and an unquestionable appetite for violence. From the remote depths of the Amazon rainforest to an abandoned monastery in Eritrea to a final showdown on the jagged mountains of Yemen, the Oregon team must use every shred of courage and cunning they can muster on this global pursuit to disable the ship killer missile before the Arabian Sea becomes a mass grave.
The morbidly obese Venezuelan, Jefferson Osorio, was the head of security for South America's largest drug cartel. His red-rimmed nostrils and eyes suggested he was addicted to his own product. Despite the temperature, he didn't button up his gaudy, full-length ermine coat, and his shoulder-length hair danced in the snowy breeze. Osorio was familiar with the elegant Russian, Yakov Mityev, and the bespectacled Chinese woman, Wu Shanshan, from the reports he'd read. Like him, they were the functional equivalents of security chiefs for their respective criminal enterprises, heading up organizations with intelligence-gathering assets that equaled or exceeded the capabilities of most nations. Had Osorio known these two world-class dirtbags were attending today's gathering, he would have made other arrangements entirely. The Venezuelan couldn't identify the others, but he assumed they were high-ranking members of their respective security departments as well. The tattoos peeking beyond the collar and sleeves of the Japanese man identified him as a Yakuza, even without the missing finger. A portly, clean-shaven Indian, a silver-toed, cowboy-booted Mexican, and a Thai Highlander wearing a bright yellow ski parka that reached to his knees rounded out the rest of the passengers. Osorio wondered if there had ever been a gathering of this level of criminal technical talent before. Police organizations around the world would salivate at the opportunity to gather them all up in one fell swoop.
Clive Cussler's Fire Strike by Mike Madden is read by Scott Brick and lasts for 14 hours and 12 minutes.
We recently acquired the first in a new historical series featuring Samuel Pepys. It's called Pleasing Mr. Pepys and is by Deborah Swift.
A metallic rattle, the key in the lock. Abigail Williams stiffened her spine as the draught from the downstairs door and the stink of the Fleet River blew round her ankles. Harrington closed the door, and she heard him scratch the flint to light the wall sconces, lighting up time already. It had been daylight when she had broken into the house. With one hand, she held her skirts closer to her thighs. With the other, she gripped the flat-bladed knife, a small weapon, but the edge sharpened razor-thin. She pressed back against the wall behind the door as the light from the hall flickered across her kidskin shoes.
Deb Willett is desperate to escape her domineering aunt and takes a position as a companion to Elizabeth Pepys, Samuel's wife. Deb believes it will give her the respectability and freedom she craves, but it proves far more complicated than she could ever have imagined. Although Charles II has been restored to the throne, there is the prospect of war with the Dutch, the world's great power of the era. In the midst of this tumult strides Samuel Pepys, diarist and man of note. Pepys's influence in Restoration London means that the Dutch are keen to get their hands on his secrets, even if it means murder, espionage and blackmail to get them.
Harrington's footsteps lumbered up the stairs, his breathing laboured. She tightened her hold on the knife, preparing herself. These breaths would be his last. She found death harder to bear than she used to, now she had seen so much suffering. Plague years, the fire. Oddly, Harrington paused on the threshold of the room, as if he could sense her waiting presence. Through the crack of the open door, she saw him, standing motionless, his steeple hat a silhouette in the wavering light, his head cocked, listening. He was an old hand, like her. She repressed a flash of compassion, the foolish urge to call out, to warn him. But then his dark back came through the door, and he stepped in front of her, and without even thinking, she moved like quicksilver.
Pleasing Mr. Pepys by Deborah Swift is narrated by Sarah Borges and runs for 14 hours, 15 minutes.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show. And now, a return to author Maggie Craig for The Books of Our Life. Was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with the reading and writing?
We're back to Jacobites. It's The Flight of the Heron by D.K. Broster. It's about an unlikely friendship between a Highland chieftain called Ewan Cameron and a redcoat English officer, and they meet as enemies. And gradually, through the course of 1745 to 46, they keep meeting and they become friends. And when you said that you wanted to know about a childhood book, I thought, I bet there's not an audio book of that. But I went, and there is. So somebody called Peter Forbes is the narrator, and he recorded it in 2021, so I shall be buying that. So I would look forward to hearing that as an audio book. I've read it about 30 or 40 times, and every time I read it, I get something new out of it.
The struggle had been conducted almost in silence, but conversation broke out again now that he was overpowered, only for a moment, however. Then, as suddenly, it ceased, and the heavy bony knees on Captain Wyndham's shoulder blades unexpectedly removed themselves. A sort of awestruck silence succeeded, with faint thoughts of druids and their sacrifices in his mind. Keith wondered whether the patriarchal soothsayer was now approaching to drive a knife with due solemnity into his back, or just possibly to denounce his descendant's violence. But he could not twist himself to look, for the man in his legs, though apparently smitten motionless, was still squatting there. And then a voice that Keith knew, vibrating with passion, suddenly shouted words in Erse whose purport he could guess. The man on his leg rose obediently. The next moment Ewan Cameron was kneeling beside him in the heather, bending over him, a hand on his shoulder. Captain Wyndham. Are you hurt? God forgive me, what have they been doing? Tied. And in a moment he'd snatched a little knife out of his stocking and was cutting Keith's hands. Oh, why did I let you out of my sight? For God's sake, tell me you're not injured. He sounded in the extreme of anxiety. And well, he might be, thought the indignant Englishman, who made no haste to reply that if exhausted he was as yet unwounded. He made, in fact, no reply at all, while the young chieftain, white with agitation and anger, helped him to his feet. When at last he stood upright, hot and dishevelled and very conscious of the fact, Captain Wyndham said, in no friendly tone, You were just in time, I think, Mr. Cameron. That is, if now that you're here, your savages will obey you.
The Flight of the Hearn is available commercially as narrated by Peter Forbes. It's also available in the RNIB Talking Books Library as narrated by Stanley Pritchard. It runs for 13 hours and 45 minutes. The next two books in the trilogy, The Dark Mile and The Gleam in the North, are also both available from RNIB as narrated by Stanley Pritchard. Is there a book on a rainy day you go back to again and again to reread?
Anything by Georgette here, who wrote Regency Romances. People think they're really frivolous, but they're just so entertaining. And there's one particular one called April Lady, which I just love. And as I said, they're completely frivolous, but they're perfectly written, and they just carry you along, and you just love the characters. She also wrote one called An Infamous Army, which is the best, I've been told by somebody in the forces, it's the best description of the Battle of Waterloo you'll ever get. So there was a harder side to what she wrote.
There was a silence in the book room. Not the silence of intimacy, but a silence fraught with tension. My lady's blue eyes, staring across the desk into my lord's cool grey ones, dropped to the pile of bills under his hand. Her fair head was hung, and her nervous hands clasped one another tightly. In spite of a modish and very expensive morning dress of twilled French silk, and the smart crop achieved for her golden curls by the most fashionable coiffeur in London, she looked absurdly youthful, like a schoolgirl caught out in mischief. She was, in fact, not yet 19 years old, and she had been married for nearly a year to the gentleman standing on the other side of the desk, and so steadily regarding her. "Well?" She swallowed rather convulsively. The Earl had spoken quite gently, but her ears were quick to catch the note of implacability in his voice. She stole a scared look up at him, and dropped her eyes again, colouring. He was not frowning, but there was no doubt that he meant to obtain an answer to the quite unanswerable question he had put to his erring bride. Another silence fell, broken only by the ticking of the large clock on the mantelpiece. My lady gripped her fingers so tightly together that they whitened. "I asked you, Nell, why all these tradesmen..." The Earl lifted the bills and let them fall again. "Have found it necessary to apply to me for the settlement of their accounts."
April Lady by Georgette Hare is narrated by Elizabeth De Silva, and it runs for 10 hours, 34 minutes. It's available from RNIB Talking Books. And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently that you'd like to recommend.
Yes, there's a book which is not long been published. It's non-fiction. I read a lot of non-fiction. And it's called Rural, The Lives of the Working Class Countryside. And it's by Rebecca Smith. Her father was a forester in the Lake District, and she now lives in Scotland. And she's talking about how if you were brought up on a country estate, you could run wild along the drive and play in and out of the rhododendron bushes, and you could play with the children in the big house, but you weren't quite on the same level as the children in the big house. So it's about those sort of things, also about how tied cottages, a lot of them don't exist anymore because the big estates thought, well, maybe we don't need a forester, and maybe we don't need a shepherd, maybe we can go in a different direction. So a lot of those houses have now become holiday homes. So the countryside is changing. She's very compassionate about people. It's not a polemic. It's not a class polemic. It's just, how do you live in the countryside if you don't earn very much and your house is damp and that sort of thing? It's just a lovely read. I really enjoyed it.
The tyres rattle over the cattle grid as a stable block appears on our left. We park behind the building, in the shadow of the beech trees that have grown further across the sky than I ever remember them being. You didn't tell us it was like this, my son Ellis says. I falter. I thought I did. It didn't look like this when I lived here. It's much fancier now. I see Phil, my partner, smile, possibly at the word fancier, possibly at Ellis's remark. The stable block was once, as the name suggests, the home for the horses of the estate and the people who looked after them. Three blocks of two-story buildings form the three sides of a square. The fourth edge was enclosed by a low wall that we used to sit and climb on as kids, with a gateway in the centre of it. There was a clock tower at the back of the square, which had never seemed to tick, even when I lived here. All the buildings are now freshly painted. The white render of the top story shines bright, and the grey mock Tudor panels are rich against it. It looks very smart. There is a line of expensive cars in the car park alongside us. I point up to the back of a building. There is a small window that looks onto the car park area, almost the same height as the biggest beech branches. There used to be an old woman who lived there. She used to look out of the window. She was terrifying. Ellis, who is 10, and Jess, only 3, look up. The window looks dark, the space around it crowded with the branches of the trees. It still looks spooky now. I have no idea who the woman was, or what she did on the estate. Maybe we made her up.
The audio version of Rural, The Lives of the Working Class Countryside, is written and read by Rebecca Smith. It runs for 7 hours, 37 minutes, is available commercially, and from R&IB Talking Books. And once again, Maggie Craig, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. It's been great fun talking about some of my favourite books.
All we've got time for on today's show, but remember, this show is also available as a podcast. There are over 300 episodes in your favourite podcast app. Just search for R&IB Read On. I'll be back at the same time next week, but remember, our daily show Talking Books, featuring the best the R&IB library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 7 a.m. with a different tale at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect.